Have you ever wondered how just new ideas happen, how they emerge? It's fascinating, the thought process that goes in to develop something, and then it becomes that, like the Tesla car, or just about anything that we have now that we use, products, ideas. In a moment, Matt Ridley joins us live from Europe as we talk about the evolution of everything, how new ideas emerge. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Matt Ridley back with us, who was on 5 years ago with our friend Ian Punnett. Gosh, that was a long time ago. Matt writes a weekly column in the Times. He writes regularly for the Wall Street Journal as well. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and the Academy of Medical Sciences. He's an honorary president of the International Center for Life in Newcastle and a noted author. And we're talking about his new work called The Evolution of Everything, How New Ideas Emerge. Fascinating subject, Matt, and welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back on the program.
God, I can't believe 5 years have gone by so quickly.
Well, me too, actually, because that was when my last book came out, which was called The Rational Optimist, and it feels just like yesterday.
I am amazed, Matt, at how just things develop, how people conceive of something, whether it's Amazon or Google now, the Tesla car, all these new emerging technologies, with somebody who's got a better idea, the folks who came up with Facebook, for example. I mean, it is fascinating to watch these new ideas emerge. It really is.
Yes, and there's a wonderfully undirected element to it. Emerge is the right word. They come from the way people interact, and they sort of. There's something inevitable about them, something incremental and inexorable, and that's what I mean by evolution. And they also come about because people combine different technologies to produce new technologies. You know, most of the technologies we have are combinations of other things. And so there's a sort of evolutionary aspect to all this, descent with modification, gradual incremental change, that I think is really interesting and that actually we end up giving a little too much credit for the people who end up top of the tree in these new ideas, who get all the credit for it. In fact, it's kind of everybody who's producing these new ideas.
Are these people, and like you just said, we sometimes give them too much credit. I mean, not all of them are particularly superbly genius type people, are they?
No, and I think they are very talented people nearly always, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of imagination to achieve what they do. But there's a sort of inevitability about it. I mean, let me give you an example. If Thomas Edison had been electrocuted before he invented the incandescent light bulb, we wouldn't have been without incandescent light bulbs. I mean, there were 23 different people who actually came up with the same idea at around the same time. Thomas Edison was just the best businessman among them. And so it's true of virtually everything you can think of. You know, Google came to prominence as a search engine company. There were lots of other search engines around at the time. It was sort of inevitable that we would all be using search engines by now, whereas, you know, when I was young, there was no such thing. There are very few inventions which would not have happened around the time they did. I mean, even relativity, discovered by Einstein rather brilliantly. Actually, a guy called Hendrik Lorentz was on the track of it and would probably have got there a few years later. And that's rather intriguing, this business of the sort of simultaneous discovery or invention of things.
Well, as we developed the atomic bomb during World War II, the Germans were right on our heels. They were working on it, too. We just beat them to the punch. Isn't it interesting that this was supposed to be an incredible secret, yet two powers at the time were working on technology that was unknown to everybody on this planet at the time, yet they were both working on the same thing? I find that to be amazing.
Yes, and actually in that example, Britain was kind of working in the same direction until it decided to send the people who are working on it over to the States and join forces with the Manhattan Project. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, you know, but I think only America could have afforded the enormous industrial muscle to get to a working atomic bomb. And to some extent, Germany was handicapped by the fact that some of its most prominent scientists just either didn't think it was possible or perhaps told Hitler it wasn't possible because they realized he wasn't a good guy. We're not quite sure about that.
They didn't want to put that kind of power in his hands, I think. They were smart.
That might be the way Heisenberg... It's very hard to tell what Heisenberg was thinking, but you know, had he had the chance to go for an atomic bomb, he probably would have done, but we're not quite sure.
What creates the knowledge, though, Matt, to have things simultaneously happen like that? Whether it's a race to go to the moon, the atomic war, it's almost like there's something out there in the ether of mankind that we tap into, and people pick up these things.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Kelly uses this word, the technium, for the sort of, you know, the organism that is our technology. And he and Brian Arthur of Stanford have argued that it's kind of alive when you think about it. It's kind of breeding its own offspring. And we're just the midwife, if you like. We come along and help make sure that the birth goes smoothly. That technology leads to more technology, and that there is a sort of incremental movement from one idea to the next, which doesn't jump ahead much. You know, you can't cheat it. You can't accelerate it, but nor can you slow it down or impede it. The best example of this is Moore's law, which is the Gordon Moore came up with this prediction that computing power would improve roughly half in price every 2 years. And that's been true ever since the 1960s when he came up with the idea, but it hasn't sped up because we know about it. It's just continued, and you can't see recessions and you can't see wars. You know, you just see this steady incremental improvement because you need each technology to invent the next technology.
Are these evolutions of things, as you call it, the evolution of everything, are they created because of the need, for example, you know, the internet? It got created. Did somebody somewhere see the need for mankind to get online? You know, Henry Ford created his Model T car because he felt that workers and people needed transportation, and it was also a vehicle for him to sell it to his own employees, gave them some more money to buy cars. Is it always based on a specific need? They find a niche and a need, and then they develop the product for it?
Well, yes and no. I think you know, with the internet, there's nobody in charge of the internet to this day. It emerges out of the fact that computers and communications have reached the point where they can talk to each other freely and easily. Now, it's necessary to have certain inventions along the way, like packet switching, to make the internet work. And it came out of labs that were used for defense, where they had a need to set up networks of communication that would survive a nuclear strike on one of the installations. You know, that was what the DARPA net was about,
right?
DARPA net, which came out of there. But in fact, you know, people say, well, therefore, you know, the military invented the internet. It's not really true, actually, because you know, there were parallel ideas in civilian life, and in fact, the military kind of sat on this technology and didn't want it commercialized for a long time. They may have even delayed the emergence of the internet to some extent. I don't see it so much as a need as so much human beings finding, creating their own needs, creating a new need, if you like. I mean, I have a need to check my emails and my texts every morning. I didn't have that when I was 10 years old because it didn't exist.
They didn't have it. That's right. That is so, so true. For, you know, for example, the internet itself, is there some central clearing place where the brain is for the internet somewhere?
No, this is one of the real gists of my book, is I'm trying to get across how decentralized the world actually is. We tend to think of the chairman of the Federal Reserve is running the economy, or the president is running the country. But when you think about it, the world is full of things that don't have a center. And the internet's a very good example of that. There is no central brain. There is no central committee. There is no command, headquarters of the internet. It's a very, very decentralized thing. And long may it remain so. I mean, if it did try to get decentralized, it would start behaving like North Korea and became, centralized, I should say. Think about the English language as another example. There is no committee that decides on the rules of the English language, thank goodness. The rules are negotiated between you and me and every other speaker of the English language, and we come up with rules like, if we're going to use a word lots, then we'll shorten it. So all the common words in English are short, and also we won't change the meanings of short words very often, whereas we'll change the meanings of long words quite often. So these are rules of the English language. You probably didn't know those two rules, but when you think about it, they're obvious. But there's no rule-making body that decides on them.
When you put together the evolution of everything, what was the genesis for you? What was the catalyst that got you to write the book?
It was, it kind of emerged, like I say it should, from my previous books, from The Rational Optimist in mm-hmm. particular, which was about, the gentle progress in human living standards and how that came about because of the cross-fertilization of ideas. And it brought together two strands of thinking in my own life. I've been an evolutionary biologist a long time ago, and I've written about evolutionary biology quite a lot. So I know a lot about natural selection and evolution, but I'm also very interested in economics, particularly in the human world. And I began to see how the way human ideas evolve, human morality, human religion, human culture, human technology, was very similar to the way biology changes and how rainforests are constructed and all that kind of thing. So I was essentially interested in exploring the analogy between evolution in the natural world and evolution in societal change in the human world.
What's up there in the horizon, Matt, 10, 15, 20 years from now, that I'm sure will change mankind again with different ideas and different things? I can't even fathom to understand what's out there.
Well, it's a good question, and whatever answer I give, you shouldn't believe it, because I'm terrible at forecasting the future. I've proved that a number of times in my life, but so is pretty well everybody else. Predictions about which technologies are about to come barreling down the pike and change our lives are notoriously bad. Where are the personal helicopters and flying cars and interstellar travel that we thought we'd have by now? On the other hand, nobody forecast the internet very well. One or two people did, Arthur C. Clarke perhaps, but nobody else. So don't believe me, but nonetheless, here's something that I see evolving now that I think might have a big impact. And that's a technology called blockchain, which is the idea behind Bitcoin. Now, I don't think Bitcoin itself is necessarily the answer to currencies, but I think the blockchain technology has all sorts of interesting implications in terms of what it might do to the world. And what it essentially means is cutting out the middleman. So you no longer need a banker to verify that your money is what it is. You no longer need a lawyer to verify that you own the property you own. You no longer need an accountant to verify that you have the money you have. It's kind of self-verifying. This is a bit hand-wavy because I don't fully understand it all myself.
Right.
But the idea is we could start cutting out lawyers and accountants out of business deals. You could even imagine companies that own themselves on the internet without any human intervention. That's a pretty far-fetched idea, but it's like the driverless car, except in the corporate space.
There's something very comforting to know when you have cash in your pocket or your wallet or your purse, knowing that you have it. But then when you really stop to think about it, the money you have in your checking account, for example, could be digitized and gone just like that. That's kind of scary, Matt.
Well, that's true. But then the thing in your pocket is just a piece of metal or a piece of paper.
That's right.
Why do you think someone's going to accept that piece of paper from you as valuable? So there are the evolution of money is a really interesting story of moving from barter to precious metal to paper to all sorts of financial devices, you know, and IOUs and debt and so on, and then through to the whole structure of banking we know, you know, and the invention of double entry bookkeeping is a crucial moment in the Renaissance. Money is continually evolving, and we get used to each new iteration. And, you know, most of us are now quite comfortable with the fact that our bank accounts consist mainly of, you know, ones and zeros.
We need a few more zeros.
Anything more tangible.
We need many more zeros, don't we?
Yes, we all need more zeros.
I love the title, yeah. The Evolution of Everything. To me, that sounds like things that are developed have a life to it, and it changes. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm trying to get across the dynamic nature of life and human society. I mean, a lovely example is morality. You know, our morality changes spectacularly.
Oh,
over
my
the
God,
centuries.
Yeah.
You know, we go from thinking that, you know, it's a virtuous thing to kill your enemies to the much more peaceful attitude we have today. You know, so there are changes in the way we treat each other, which and for a long time priests have taken the credit and said, look, that's because we've told you that you've got to be nice to each other. Well, actually, they're just reflecting what society is doing. I mean, you know, religion tends to reflect back to us what we consider to be virtuous, and we kind of negotiate it among ourselves.
Yet, I think back at the earlier days of television in the 50s, where TV was so simple, so clean cut, so cut and dry, and then how it has changed, where you'll see things on cable television now, Matt, that, you know, will just go, whoa, how things have changed, where back in the 1950s, there's no way that would have gotten on television, or they didn't really have cable then. But, I mean, those things have changed too, haven't they?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting phenomenon, I find, because there are conventions in film and television now that, you know, you and I understand, but that would be mysterious to our parents and grandparents about, you know, how fast the camera moves and how much people mumble and all that kind of thing. You know, we've got used to a completely different art form of film, and no doubt, well, I can already feel it, that there are some modern movies and television series that I just find a bit baffling because I can't quite keep up, but my kids find them quite normal. So we're evolving our tastes for television and film at the same time as the technology is evolving. And it's hard to, I mean, you know, can this go on for another 100 years? Another 100 years of television, what would it look like? It'll be very, very different. You know, obviously there'll be a lot more CGI and that kind of thing, but at a certain point, it'll go backwards, and yet it'll change. And I think if you and I were dropped 100 years into the future, we might find it very hard. Well, we'd certainly find it hard to turn the television on, I'm sure.
Gosh, I remember it. I remember as a kid, man. I remember as a kid that people, we've got a second lag here because of the distance here. You're in the United Kingdom, but people would talk about flat screen television sets on your wall. I thought that was impossible. Now look at it.
Exactly. No, that's a nice example, and mobile video. I mean, the idea that you can watch a film on your telephone, it would just be baffling to our ancestors. And yet, you know, as I said before, remember they thought we'd be using personal gyrocopters and supersonic travel by now, and we're not.
So we're a little late, but we'll get there. Matt, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. But we'll come right back with you on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about the evolution of everything. And welcome back to Coast with our guest, Matt Ridley. His book, The Evolution of Everything, and his website linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Matt, you start with the concept called skyhooks. Tell me what that means.
Yes. A skyhook is an imaginary device by which you attach to a cloud in order to be able to build a skyscraper from the top down. Now, obviously, that thing doesn't exist, and the word was invented by a First World War reconnaissance pilot in an airplane, telling the people who had told him to stay up there, "This machine is not fitted with skyhooks." Now, the point about this analogy is it was used by the great evolutionary thinker Daniel Dennett as a sort of metaphor for magical explanations of things, top-down explanations in particular, rather than bottom-up ones. And what he says is that the idea that there is a designer designing the eye or the brain of a human being is a skyhook explanation in the end, that actually these things emerge gradually over time through evolution. So I'm saying that kind of magical top-down explanations of the world, either through superstition or through some other means, are actually very common. We use skyhooks all the time. So, for example, the government is running the economy is a skyhook type explanation. No, it's not. It's presiding over the economy. We are running the economy, everybody, you and me. And that's kind of my point, is to try and get people to see the world in a more bottom-up way and a less top-down way.
There was a Roman philosopher, Lucretius, lived in the B.C. era. You write a lot about him. Tell me about his influence on your work.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by Lucretius. We don't know a lot about him. He wrote one long poem, which he didn't finish, and he came to a sticky end, perhaps, when he was in the middle of writing a verse, around 49 BC, we think. And he was an empiricist. He was someone who believed that the world is what you see, that there's nothing else. In particular, he said the world consists of atoms and voids. Lots of little particles, lots of big spaces, nothing else. And everything around you is made of atoms and voids. And actually, there's nothing else. There's not spirits. There's not essences. It's just particles and nothingness. And of course, that's spot on. That's the atomic theory we now live with, that even your brain is made of atoms and spaces between atoms. And he was relentless in saying, let's get rid of the magic in the world. Let's get rid of the superstition. Let's see the world as just what it is. And in particular, he hit upon some ideas about how evolution happened, how creatures had changed over time, which turn out to be absolutely spot on. So he was well ahead of his time. But of course, he was suppressed by Christian. When Christians came along, they actually they burnt his works and buried his ideas, and he was completely forgotten about until the 1400s, when his work was rediscovered in a library in Germany. A copy that hadn't been destroyed was found lying there, and it became an enormously important influence on the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, on people like Spinoza and even Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson had five copies of Lucretius in his library, some in Latin, some in Greek, etc. He was a really important source of ideas about the bottom-up world, about the evolutionary world.
He was 44 when he died. Was that considered old then?
That's a pretty good innings in those days, I guess. But he was a contemporary of Julius Caesar and Cicero. Cicero didn't approve of him, of course, because he was much too radical a thinker. And to some extent, Virgil was reacting against Lucretius. So, if you tell me who'd you like to go back in history and meet, I'd quite like to meet Lucretius. His poem was called De Rerum Natura, which means on the nature of things.
You threw a little curveball at us because you talk a lot about the evolution of everything. Marriage. Tell me about this.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the polygamous marriage is common in the ancient world, particularly in agricultural societies. And gradually over time, you get an incremental movement to disapproval of polygamy and approval of monogamy. And it goes backwards in some places, and it goes faster forwards in others. But when you think about it, this isn't because somebody comes along and outlaws it. It's because gradually society itself comes to disapprove of polygamous marriage. Polygamous marriage persists much longer in societies than pastoral societies where people are herding goats and sheep and cattle than it does in other societies for interesting reasons. Probably.
Oh, are you still there? We have lost you, so let's try to get you back on cell phone out there in the United Kingdom. We'll call you right back, Matt, and pick you up and get you back. But look, folks, we're talking about his work, which is called The Evolution of Everything, How New Ideas Emerge. And quite amazing, some of the things. I mean, when you look at the various things of technology, and I just like the current technology, and we'll let Matt address some of the older things when he gets back on, that Facebook, for example, you remember when MySpace was there, right? MySpace was the thing. Everybody talked about MySpace. Everybody wanted to become part of MySpace. That thing died so fast. It was unbelievable. I mean, it just died right away. And then Facebook popped up. And it just, poof, it was gone. And Facebook took over and did what it had to do. And it was just dramatic. But, Matt, we've got you back talking about technology, huh? You're many, many thousands of miles away, but we got you back on.
I don't know how that happened. Sorry.
That's all right. That's all right. We were talking about the marriage aspect of the evolution of everything. So I'll let you pick up from there.
Yeah, I don't know where I'd got to, but I was talking about how polygamous systems had disappeared and monogamous systems had appeared in their place gradually through the way people interacted. And of course, the problem with a polygamous society is that a lot of young men don't get to marry at all because the rich men have grabbed all the women. And that means that they're pretty keen on violence because they need to go and grab women from somewhere. And so a lot of polygamous societies declare war on their neighbors. And so one of the reasons for the emergence of monogamy was to try and impose peace on a society. And it's actually quite an interesting pattern that you see all over the world, actually, is that, you know, as monogamy gradually becomes the moral norm, so violence tends to decline. So these are the historical patterns in the way human society is constructed and behaves that I'm interested in cataloging.
You know, while we were getting you back on, Matt, I was talking about what Facebook did to MySpace. I mean, it just annihilated it. And they have been smart enough, the folks who run Facebook, to gobble up some of its competition, Snapchat, WhatsApp, and things that are out there, Instagram, because they didn't want what happened to MySpace to happen to them. But do you think a giant like Facebook can get toppled by another type of internet social network?
I certainly do, not because there's anything wrong with Facebook, but because that's the pattern we're seeing these days, is that your time at the top gets shorter and shorter. You know, when I was a young adult, IBM was invincible. And then along comes Microsoft, and then Microsoft was invincible, and then along comes Apple, and, you know, so there's a continual turnover. And if you look at the Fortune 500 or whatever, you see there's a more rapid turnover in who's the biggest companies in the world than they used to be, and it's a competitive process. And of course, competition is a key part of evolution. It makes it possible for replacement of one idea by another. And however good Facebook is, at some point it'll get complacent, it'll get stuck in an old technology, it'll get too big to change fast, or whatever. Google's done a great job of making itself the kind of place that keeps evolving, so it keeps up with its competitors, Facebook ditto, but they, I'd be surprised if they don't see their time in the sun come to an end as well.
And as you look at things that are happening with the internet, look what the internet has done, at least in the United States, to a lot of retail establishments. I mean, I think it has hurt newspapers. It has hurt some bricks and mortar retail companies because people do a lot of shopping online now. I mean, if you took all the billions that were spent online this year and gave it to the retail stores, they'd be doing pretty good. But, I mean, they're in trouble. Sears is in trouble. JCPenney, they're in trouble in this country. The internet, Matt, has done that and changed it dramatically.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that's a really crucial thing that's happening in our study. I mean, I went online the other day and bought a new pair of shoes, and they arrived yesterday. They fit perfectly, you know, and I haven't been inside a shop. Well, that's not quite true, but I haven't been inside I haven't been shopping for years, really.
Right.
In the sort of old-fashioned sense of the word.
If you don't need something right now, if you don't need something instantly, the internet is a great way to shop.
And if I want a book instantly, it's quicker to get it on the internet and deliver it tomorrow than find a bookstore, hope it's got the book, etc. So it has changed things. But of course, the book example is quite nice because while it's true that I read a lot of books online on devices, I also still read old-fashioned books. I'm just old-fashioned enough to like the physical thing. But in a funny way, the internet has enabled that to work because it's mm-hmm. so easy to get hold of the physical book just by ordering it. And I can order the really obscure book that the bookstore is not going to have, you know, the thing about 14th century fingernail cutting or whatever it is that is my particular passion. I made that up, by the way.
But you get that discount, too.
Fingernails. Exactly. I get it at a discount. And someone somewhere in the world will have an original first edition of the 14th century fingernail cutting manual. And I'll be able to find him through one of these networks who will be able to send it from, you know, I don't know, somewhere in the United States or something to my home.
Eventually, I think you're going to be able to shop for groceries, which you would think would be unspeakable to buy on the internet. Will get delivered that day to you.
Well, a lot of people do that already in this country. I don't know, you know, not necessarily that day, but the next day or delivery. And we do that a certain amount in our home. Not all the time, because they turn up and say they haven't got something, so they substitute something else. But you know, a lot of we order a certain amount of food over the internet, my wife and I.
What is your big newspaper in the United Kingdom? I mean, here we've got the New York Times, of course, and the Wall Street Journal. But how about you? Is what is your big print newspaper?
Britain, unlike America, where most newspapers are local, Britain has a very strong number of national newspapers. It also has local newspapers, and those national newspapers, there's about seven or eight of them: the Times, the Telegraph, the Guardian, the Financial Times, the Daily Mail, the Daily mm-hmm. Mirror, the Sun. You know, these are. They all cater for different aspects of the market, and some of them are surviving the internet better than others.
Yes.
I mean, they're all suffering. You know, none of them have anything like the circulation that they used to have, and young people just don't buy
newspapers. No, they don't. Everything's internet. I know the Mirror's doing well, the Daily Mirror and the Guardian. They're doing great on the internet. The BBC News, they're doing great on the internet. But you've just brought up something very fascinating. Let's talk about demographics for a moment, because it is a changing world that we are in. These younger people today, Matt, who will get their news and information via social network and also the internet, they may read The Guardian online, but they won't go pick up a newspaper and read it. And, you know, even my habits are changing. Will that stay with them when they get older, or will they revert to some of the older customs that older folks are doing right now? Because newspapers cater to an older demographic. When these younger kids get older, will they still be part of this technological age, or will they kind of replace the older folks who are doing the thing right now?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I was thinking about that yesterday. Funnily enough, when I was on the London Underground, and I was just looking at a man, a very pretty elderly man with a ponytail, and I remember thinking, you know, when I was young, old men didn't have ponytails, and that's not because old men have changed their habits; it's because young men have grown old. If you see what
that's
I mean.
Right,
men with ponytails have grown old, so I think it's very unlikely that today's young people will sort of suddenly start buying paper newspapers when they get to a certain age. I think that, you know, habits do change in that sense and they'll get stuck. On the other hand, there are some things we do when we get older that, you know, we take up the habits of our parents, as it were. Like, I don't know, young people don't play a lot of golf. I imagine they will play more golf when they get older. But on the whole, I think we see society changing and the young people changing fastest, and they will then keep those habits for life. There are some fascinating little things going on, like the ability to do laparoscopic surgery, you know, keyhole surgery.
Oh, yeah.
It turns
dramatic.
Out that young people coming into the surgeon's profession nowadays are really, really good at it because they've played so many video games.
Well, no, you're right. You're right about that. In terms of being a pilot, sadly, I think some of our shootings are based a lot in part by the dexterity that video games have given younger people who happen to be crazed individuals who get guns. And it's got its downside, yeah. Too, doesn't it?
There's no doubt about it. There are horrible downsides, and we're seeing them with cybercrime at the moment, a big issue. I'm on the whole optimistic about this kind of thing, though, because if you look at, you know, how worried we were 15 years ago about computer viruses, how they were going to destroy all our programs and so on, well, they're still a problem, but they're not winning, as it were. You know, we're able to keep one step ahead of the criminals in the computer viruses, likewise in cybercrime. And the reason for that is because we've got open source. We can go online and freely and transparently tell each other what we've come up with. And by we, I mean the good guys. The bad guys can't do that. You know, the bad guys have to keep their thinking and their development secret. And that makes them less effective at developing. So they're always going to be one step behind us. That's not to say they won't get some victories along the way.
Well, indeed, indeed. Would you tell us where we can get your book, The Evolution of Everything?
Well, it was published last weekend. It's called The Evolution of Everything, How New Ideas Emerge. It's published by HarperCollins in the United States, and it's in all good bookstores or on online sales as we speak, I hope.
Okay, and let's let things emerge by taking phone calls with you next, Matt, right here on Coast to Coast AM.